Happy Sabbath. Good morning, everyone. Seems like such an abrupt beginning of services today because I'm standing out here talking. I hear the music. I come in, get my seat, find out that the sermonette's not going to be here, and here I am up here. I haven't had time to wind up for this yet. Let me tell you that Mr. Zimmerman sends his love and duress. He is miserable with shingles. I went over there last evening, and with his wife being gone, how is it to be a elderly guy with no wife at home to take care of you? So I took him something to eat because I know he didn't want to cook for himself. And he looks miserable. His back has spots, just full of chicken pox looking things. And he's coming along, but he's miserable. He hasn't been with a shirt on for a couple of days because he can't even put one on. And so you need to pray for him. You know, he needs your prayers. But he sends his love, and we were together supposed to give the covenants presentation over in Tampa like we did here last week. And he called me to tell me, you know, that he wasn't going to be up to it. And I told him I wasn't wanting to give it over there without him because it kind of works as a team play. And he says, okay, well, just give another message over there. I said, fine. And he says, I have one more thing I'd like for you to do. And he says, I have the sermon over in St. Pete. And I knew what the next question was going to be, was to come back here. And so I'm not here as much as I'd like to be, so it's 2 weeks in a row. So I hope you can stand me. My wife is not here because our daughter, who's been in Europe for the last 4 months, came back Thursday evening and slept all day yesterday because time zone changes. She was supposed to come in on Monday, and we had the storm. She was supposed to fly from Frankfurt to JFK. Well, that was canceled, and so we arranged for her to stay over in Germany for a few more days, and then they called her and said they had a flight to go to Atlanta from Frankfurt on Delta. So when she came in, she was tired because she had traveled like 21 hours and plus the time lag. So last night she said, it was about mid-afternoon, she said, I'm tired, I just have kind of like this headache, like I haven't slept for a while, and she hadn't, you know. So she went to sleep, and then she got up this morning early. I heard her in the kitchen about 6 o'clock, and so then my wife got up with me, I had coffee with them, and so now they're still having coffee, and I'm here, but that's okay. I didn't have breakfast, though, they did. So I had a couple messages in mind, and I was torn between which one to give. And I knew the one I was going to give over in Tampa. And it was all set. But then I got to thinking, you know, a good follow-up to last week would be the message that I have on Islam and Israel and Ishmael. Because it is one of those messages that if you can look back and see some of its beginnings and you can stand back and look at the earth today, you can see where God said something there that's here today. And that's pretty powerful when you look back into history and you see where God said something and then it's here today. I have brought my copy of the Quran, which I will read just a couple passages out of there, which is an illegal Quran, because it's an illegal Quran because if it's not written in Arabic, it's not official. Okay, I don't know if you knew that or not. It's considered an illegal Quran. So once again, happy Sabbath to all of you, and I will begin with this story. I'm going to read this story called The Brothers and the Story of Islam. This story has been around a long time, and I'll tell you some of the history of it after I read the story. Once there were two brothers who inherited their father's land. The brothers divided the land in half, and each one farmed his own section. Over time, the older brother married and had 6 children, while the younger brother never married. One night, the younger brother lay awake. It's not fair that each of us has half the land to farm, he thought. My brother has 6 children to feed, and I have none. He should have more grain than I do. So that night, the younger brother went to his silo, gathered a large bundle of wheat, climbed the hill that separated the two farms over to his brother's farm. Leaving the wheat in his brother's silo, the younger brother returned home, feeling pleased with himself. Earlier that very same night, the older brother was also lying awake. It's not fair that each of us has half the land to farm, he thought. In my old age, my wife and I will have grown children to take care of us, not to mention grandchildren, while my brother will probably have none. He should have at least more grain than I do in his fields so that he can provide for himself with dignity in his old age. So that night, too, he secretly gathered a bundle of wheat, climbed the hill, left it in his brother's silo, returned home, feeling pleased with himself. The next morning, the younger brother was surprised to see the amount of grain in his barn was unchanged. "I must not have taken as much wheat as I thought," he said to himself. "Bemused, tonight, I'll be sure to take more." That very same moment, his brother also was standing in his barn, musing at the same thought. After night fell, each brother gathered a great amount of wheat from his barn and in the dark, secretly delivered it to his brother's barn. The next morning, the brothers were again puzzled and perplexed. "How can I be mistaken?" Each one scratched their head. "There's the same amount of grain here as there was before. I cleared the pile for my brother. This is impossible. Tonight I'll make no mistake. I'll take the pile down to the very floor. That way I'll be sure that the grain gets delivered to my brother." The third night, more determined than ever, each brother gathered a large pile of wheat from his barn, loaded it into a cart, slowly pulled his haul through the fields and up to the hill to his brother's barn. At the top of the hill, under the shadow of a moon, each brother noticed a figure in the distance. Who could it be? When the two brothers recognized the form of the other brother and the load was that each one was pulling behind, they realized what had happened, and without a word, they dropped the ropes to their carts, ran, and embraced. This story is passed down in both Hebrew and Arabic versions. In the Hebrew version, King Solomon is believed to have built the first temple on the ground where the two brothers met and embraced. In the Arab version, at the end of the story, in the morning, each brother was amazed to find the heap still equal till Allah sent a prophet who informed them that their unselfish love was pleasing to the Almighty. Hebrews often call the story the Talmudic legend, because they say it was taken from the Midrash, though it was not. That's just legend. And there's a professor who studied it for a period of time because he really wanted to know who started this. It was a Hungarian professor, and he said it actually came from a French historian in 1851. But the story has been equally claimed by both groups because they want to be the one to say it was my idea to have this kind of peace. Come with me, please, to Genesis 16. Do you remember last week when we talked about David and we said that the moon was set up there in Psalm 89, I think it is, where it was a sign? It's interesting that they have this shadow of the moon in the background as a sign that Jesus Christ would be the ultimate descendant of David to be our king and ruler. Just like we've been having the moon out there now, it should be more than just that full moon means it's time to start a holy day. It's more than that. Let's go to Genesis 16. I can't remember who asked this question, but somebody asked this question about why is it that when you're 13 years old that they circumcise in the Islam faith? Somebody asked that question. We're going to answer it, so in case you don't have it. not even intentionally, accidentally, because it's in this series of scripture. Genesis 16, verse 1. "Now Sarai, Abram's wife, bore him no children, and she had a handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, 'Behold, now the Lord has restrained me from bearing, so I pray you, go into my maid. It may be that I may obtain children by her.' And Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. And Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, and gave her to her husband, Abram, to be his wife. And he went into Hagar." That would be a hard thing to do, I imagine. "And he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her eyes." And oh, can you see that? And Sarai said to Abram, "My wrong be upon you. I have given my maid into your bosom." And when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. And the Lord judge between me and you. And Abram said to Sarai, "Behold, your maid is in your hand. Do to her as it pleases you." And when Sarai dealt hardly with her, she fled from her face. And the angel of the Lord found her by a fountain of water in the wilderness, by the fountain in the way of Shur. And he said, "Hagar, Sarai's maid, where came you, and where will you go?" And she said, "I flee from the face of my mistress Sarai." And the angel of the Lord said to her, "Return to your mistress and submit yourself under her hands." And the angel of the Lord said to her, "I will multiply your seed exceedingly, that it shall not be numbered for multitude." And the angel of the Lord said to her, "Behold, you are with child, and shall bear a son, and shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction. And he will be a wild man, and his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him, and he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren." And she called the name of the Lord that spoke to her, "You, God, see me," for she said, "Have I also here looked after him that sees me?" This story is a story of two women. One, both of them having God's hand on them, actually. But one is going to bear a son who God said he would be with for a period of time in his covenant promise, which is what we covered last week. So this is actually a good message to tack on to last week while it's hot in your mind. So you look in verse 15 there, "And Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called his son's name, which Hagar bore, Ishmael." You have Ishmael over here now. "And Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Abram." How old is that? 86. Okay, chapter 17, verse 1. "When Abram was 90 years old and 9. 86 to 99, 13 years. Okay. "I am the Almighty God. Walk before me and be you perfect. And I will make my covenant, my contract between me and you, and will multiply you exceedingly." And Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, he fell on his face. Brethren, he fell on his face. How many times have you fallen on your face when you've been told something? He fell on his face when he heard this. And God said, "As for me, behold, my covenant, my contract is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations." Huge promise. "Neither shall your name any more be called Abram, but your name shall be called Abraham, for a father of many nations have I made you. And I will make you exceeding fruitful, and I will make nations out of you, and kings shall come out of you." And he just beats it up. "And I will establish my covenant, my contract between me and you and your seed after you in their generations for an everlasting covenant, an everlasting agreement, an everlasting contract to be a God to you and to your seed after you. And I will give to you and to your seed after you the land wherein you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God." It was difficult for Abraham to grab a hold of what this meant. This is a huge promise. Verse 9, "And God said to Abraham, you shall keep my covenant, therefore you and your seed after you and their generations. For this is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your seed after you. Every man-child among you shall be circumcised, and you shall circumcise the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be a token of the covenant between me and you. And he that is 8 days old shall be circumcised among you, every child in your generations." Verse 13, "He that is born in your house and he that is bought with your money must needs to be circumcised, and my covenant shall be in your flesh." The sign here is very clear what he's saying. If we go down to verse 15, "And God said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai anymore, but Sarah shall be her name. And I will bless her and give you a son also of her. And I will bless her and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of people shall be of her. And Abraham fell upon his face and laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born to him that is 100 years old And shall Sarah, that is 90 years old, bear? And Abram said to God, Oh, that Ishmael might live before you. And God said, Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son indeed, and you shall call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him. Not with Ishmael, with Isaac. For an everlasting covenant, and with his seed after him. And as for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I have blessed him. Not covenanted with him, blessed him. Will make him fruitful, will make him multiply exceedingly. 12 princes shall he father, and I will make him a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, which Sarah shall bear to you at this time next year. Here's where you find the separation where 13-year-old Ishmael is circumcised. As a sign of that covenant, because he was a household of Abraham. So there's your answer to the why 13. They continue that to this day to honor Ishmael, as opposed to we do it in the eighth day. Okay? Come with me, please, to Genesis 25. I've told some of you this before, but for me it's so important that when I speak up here that I give you something that you can remember and grab a hold of and go home with. And something that is going to make you think about where you are in your life for at least another week. And it's so important that I can communicate it clearly to you in this way. And I'm going to try to paint this picture where you will see the story that God has been developing on the face of the earth for 4,000 years. A long time, possibly five, actually, depending on how you age some of this. Genesis 25, verse 19. And these are the generations of Isaac, Abram's son. Abraham fathered Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah as a wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian, of Padan-Aram, the sister of Laban, the Syrian. And Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife, because she was barren, and the Lord was entreated of him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. And the children struggled together inside her, and she said, If it be so, why am I thus? And she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, Two nations are in your womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from your bowels. And the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. And when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. And that's the beginning in the story that you know of Esau and Jacob. Now, I know you know all of that, but I'm trying to point out you have the development of two lines, an Ishmael line and an Israel line. I'm going to tell you the story about the Barbary pirates without trying to act like one. The Barbary pirates were Muslim pirates. They operated from modern-day Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, and Libya. From the time of the Crusades until the early 19th century is when they were there. They often made raids on European coastal towns to capture Christian slaves, to sell these slaves at the markets in such places as Algeria and Morocco. Don't know if you knew that or not. You always hear a different slave story. This is an interesting slave story. It is estimated that from the 16th to the 19th century, pirates captured 1 million to 1.5 million Europeans as slaves. France, England, and Spain each lost thousands of ships in these attacks. Long stretches of coast in Spain where they almost completely abandoned the inhabitants there because it was a fearful place to be. In 1783... And now we really turn up the clock, Ishmael and Israel, way up to 1783. Long time has gone by now. The United States won its freedom from the British monarchy, which had been paying tribute money to the pirates. In 1784, the first American ship was seized by the pirates of Morocco. Two more ships were seized in 1785 by Algeria. In 1786, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, then the ambassadors to France and Britain, respectively, met with the Libyan ambassadors. Sound familiar? To Britain, and Sidi Adja, who was the ambassador, was asked, why does the government treat the American ships so hostilely? The ambassador's response was, and this was to the complete Continental Congress, it is our right to plunder and to enslave. Where did he get that from? Let's keep that in your head. Where did he get that from? After some serious debate over what to do, the United States chose to fight the pirates of Barbary rather than to pay tribute. As did all the nations who traded in the Mediterranean Sea, the decision was bold, and the United States Navy was born. The United States succeeded and won the battle for independence of piracy. Do we see piracy today? It's the same thing. Same thing, years later. Let's summarize real quickly here the Israel line with the lineage mentioned in the book of Matthew. I'm going to try to weave this together so you can see how much is happening before your face that you could just be not connecting the dots. Matthew 1, verse 1. The book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. That's a lot of time there, from Abraham to David, from David to Jesus Christ. Okay, there's first 14 generations from Abraham to the calling of David. Then there's another 14 generations from the building of the temple to the destruction of it. That's the way this is separated, in case you never knew that. It's separated in three groups of 14 generations each. And the third group of generations begins with the nation of Israel under Babylon and ends with Israel under the power of control of Rome. And that's how you come up to Jesus Christ. Those are your three. Jesus to David, David to Abraham. It breaks it up into three different groups, three different sections of 14 generations. Verse 17. So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. And from David until the carrying away in Babylon are 14 generations. And from the carrying away in Babylon to Christ are 14 generations. Very determined 14 generations. Who carves out 14 generations at a time? Who is able to do that? Only God. It's a proof. Right there is a proof that God exists. Say, why does God exist? You know, or I don't believe God exists, or we came from amoebas, all that kind of stuff. Okay? Right here is a proof that God exists. No one can do this. No one person. Only God can craft this up. And you go back in history and say, hey, who did that? Statistically, it wouldn't be possible. It'd be like winning the lottery several times in a row. That's how statistically impossible it would be. Let's go to Genesis 28. I'll go back now to where we were. Genesis 28. Begin in verse 1. And Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him, commanded him, and said to him, you shall not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. Arise. I wonder why. This was the other line of Ishmael developing. Okay? Arise, go to Padanaram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take you a wife from there of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. And God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful, multiply you, that you may be a multitude of people. And give you the blessing of Abraham to you and to your seed with you, that you may inherit the land wherein you are a stranger, which God gave to Abraham. And Isaac sent away Jacob, and he went to Padanaram to Laban, son of Bethuel the Syrian, the brother of Rebekah, Jacob's and Esau's mom. When Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Padanaram to take him a wife from there, and that as he blessed him, he gave him charge, saying, you shall not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. And then Jacob obeyed his father and his mother and was gone to Padanaram. And Esau, okay, here you start seeing this little feisty part of the left hand here of Ishmael. And Esau, seeing that the daughters of Canaan pleased not Isaac his father, what did he do? Verse 9, then he went to Ishmael and took to the wives, which he had Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nehabith, to be his wife. He was told not to do it, but he did it anyway. They both were told not to do it. You start to see the development of the line and the blessings of Ishmael and Israel way back here. And when you start to turn it up, you start to see this animosity carries on through centuries. Who carries the animosity? How does it just go? Do you think it runs in the blood genetically? This is through God's watching and Satan's involvement. It is a constant match back and forth. You see this occur, and I'll get into Muhammad in just a second here. But you see, as you know, Constantine came into Rome. This isn't in my notes, but I have a few extra minutes because Mr. Terry gave them to me. Thank you, Mr. Terry. When Constantine came into Rome, his dad had given him the rulership of Rome. And he was worried about the south. The south side of the empire was not happy about him coming into rule. So he had to craft a way to bring it all together. So he sent on into the whole Holy Roman Empire groups, legions of soldiers, to collect up all the riches. So they went from temple and town to collect up all the riches to bring it back to Rome. And I think I've said this before, no cell phones, no computers. When they said go, you go. If you didn't come back with what you were supposed to come back with, when you came back, you were gone. You know, you had to do what you were done. One word, you go. Strength and honor, it's all over. So they went down, they came back after 12 years. They came back and they brought all the riches that they could find in his kingdom. And that's when they had this great meeting that crafted up what we come to know as a universal religion, Catholicism. It all came into Rome. They even dissected the Colosseum, everything from the Colosseum, all the marble, everything that was there. That's why today it's real bony looking, just stone, because that's left over after Constantine in 300 had all this done. So when they had this gathering with all of these riches is when they decided, now what are we going to do? We got to bring this all together. So he formed the Vatican, which is the center of the universal religion we now know as Catholicism. So if you ever go to the Vatican, you see rooms of everything they collected up. You see the big urns where the firstborns were sacrificed. Huge urns, bigger than this table, this whole area. Marble, this thick, going down. You know, where they would cut the throat of the firstborn, put them in there and sacrifice them. You see that inside of the Vatican, and all the different weird shapes for all the different gods that they made marble of, all that's in there. That beginning of that particular religion was also to be the antithetical fighting side against the Quran and Muhammad and that group of people. Muslims are the people, Islam's the religion. Okay. They specifically did that because they didn't want to be a follower of, like, we're Christians, followers of Christ. They didn't want to be, like, named after Muhammad. They didn't want to be Mohammedans. So they call the religion Islam, and they say they're Muslims, and they only honor Allah, who they believe is the Father, God the Father, which I will show you has some real difficulties. Okay? So 250 years... after this is developed in Constantine with the universal religion, we have a guy who is born in Kedar called Muhammad. And this fellow is born in Mecca. He's from the lineage of Kedar, I should say. If you don't know who Kedar is, okay, Kedar goes all the way back. He is the great-grandson of Ishmael. Okay, so what they say is Muhammad says he came from Kedar. In that lineage. He's carrying on the Ishmael lineage. And they say they can prove that. I can't say. All I can say is they say in Arabian history, that's true. I can't speak to it other than that's what they say in the books. His dad died. Muhammad's dad died when he was young. He was 6 years old. And then his mom later on died. And he married a 40-year-old widow when he himself was 25. The widow he married was very wealthy because the person she was married to before was very influential, had a lot of money. So then Muhammad was introduced to these groups of people that had wealth and power inside of Saudi Arabia at the time. They would go to a cave outside of Mecca and do meditations. It was very common for them to do it as a group. When Muhammad was 40, 15 years later, he had his first dream. His dream that came upon him caused him to find himself on the ground, rolling, and it says, foaming at the mouth. I'm not making that up. And when he got up, believed he had been visited from the angel Gabriel. And over a period of 22 years, he had 17 dreams. Within these 17 dreams, he would recite in Arabic what came to him in the dream. He was illiterate, was unable to read or write. So when he would awake, he would have a scribe come and write down exactly what he told them to write down. And all of these things, dreams that came to him when he was in this trance-like state, is where you get the Quran. This book is 22 years compiled, 17 dreams from Muhammad. That's what this book is, as opposed to the Bible. Okay, you know how that was constructed. All right. This was constructed around the years 620 to about 640, 635, something like that. That's when this book was put together. I think I mentioned to you earlier that if it's not in Arabic, it's not considered legal. He would recite this exactly the way it came to him, and no one's able to touch it. Not allowed to change it. He has warnings in here. If you change it, you shall be put to death. Things like that. Which, you know, even in our Bible, it says, woe to anyone that takes what's in the scriptures and changes it. You know, it's actually in there. Okay, he died in 632. Muhammad died in 632 when he was 62 years old. This book, the Quran, has 144 chapters in it. And they're called different things, the surah, the story, the believers. And of those 140 chapters, it has verses just like we do. So if I said 119:1, you just go to chapter 119, verse 1, and read it. All right? That's the way it's accessed. I'm telling you these things because there's a few scriptures in here you might want to know. You know, like the idea in chapter 4 that it says, I think I marked this one, and this one's called The Woman, chapter 4, verse 157. They declared, "We have put to death the Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, the apostle of God." But they did not kill him, nor did they crucify him. They only thought they did. Okay. This is not storyline to them. This is fact to them. So when you tell them you're a Christian, that you believe in Jesus Christ, and you have a cross around, or they see that you have a cross around, or if you say that, they say, you're wrong. It didn't happen. You've been hoodwinked. See? So it's important you realize where they're coming from. Okay? Because then you have a little bit of understanding on how to handle it when you read it, when you see it. For 100 years after Muhammad died, Baghdad ruled as the city in the Muslim Empire. It was to the place where if you didn't do what was in here, you were killed. You had a choice. Submit to Allah and the Quran or be killed. There's nothing in between. Well, I'd like to think about... No, there was nothing in between. No tolerance. Zero tolerance. Well, this got to the place where it was intolerable for the Vatican. And what happened there? Does anybody remember? The Crusades. That's how the Crusades were born. Seven Crusades, just the opposite. If you believed in this and Allah and not the cross, okay, it was over with. Now, infuse here the whole idea of Ishmael and Israel and this history of belief and religion being so emotional, and you got a real problem. Okay? Like you do today.
just like you do today. Come with me to John 1. The funny part about John 1 is this. Is Muslims use John 1 to prove that Muhammad was prophesied, but they don't recognize the Bible. I'm serious. So if you don't recognize the Bible, but you use the Bible to say that proves why where Muhammad was prophesied, you're picking and choosing. You know, so either use it or don't use it, but don't use it when you want to, otherwise it has no, you know, its authority is very weak at best. John 1, and let's begin in John 1, verse 19. And this is the record of John, when the Jews sent priests and Levites from Jerusalem to ask him, "Who are you?" And he confessed and denied not, but confessed, "I'm not the Christ." So, okay, John, you're not the Christ. And then they asked him, "Well, what then? Are you Elijah?" And he said, "Well, I'm not Elijah." "Well, are you that prophet?" And he answered, "No." Okay, so John basically says, "I am not Jesus Christ, I am not Elijah, and I'm not the prophet." Okay, as if it's three separate entities. He's just saying, "I am not them." Verse 22, "And then said they to him, 'Well, who are you, that we may give an answer to them that sent us? What say you of yourself?'" Then the famous response in verse 23, "I am the voice of one crying out in the wilderness, 'Make straight the way of the Lord,' as said the prophet Isaiah." And verse 25, "And then they asked him and said to him, 'Why baptize you then, if you be not the Christ, Elijah, nor the prophet?'" Their interrogation was, "Why are you baptizing? Why are you baptizing?" That's what the line of questioning is here. Verse 26, "John answered them and said, 'I baptize with water, but there stands one among you whom you know not. He it is who is coming after me, is preferred before me, whose shoes latchet I am not worthy to unloose.'" So the line of questioning had to do, why are you baptizing? Who are you that you think you can baptize and do this? That's the line of questioning. It's not a matter of, okay, let me see here. You're not Jesus Christ, you're not Elijah, you're not the prophet. We know who Elijah is because he was back there. We now know who Christ is because he's here. So the prophet is still to come. That prophet is Muhammad. That's how they get to that. All right? In reality, what it should be is that Jesus Christ, which I'll show you, is also the prophet. Let's go to Matthew 12. They will vehemently fight on this point, that this is where Muhammad comes from. Okay, so let's see here. Matthew 12, verse 17. "That it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, 'Behold, my servant, whom I've chosen, my beloved, in whom my soul is well pleased, I will put my spirit upon him, and he shall show judgment to the Gentiles. He shall not strive, nor cry, neither shall any man hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed shall he not break, a smoking flax shall he not quench, till he send forth judgment to victory, and in his name shall the Gentiles trust.'" Okay, now hold on to that thought. Let's go to Matthew 3, describing Jesus Christ there. Matthew 3. Another commendation of who Jesus Christ is, Matthew 3, verse 17. "And lo, a voice from heaven saying, 'This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased.'" Okay, and now let's go one more in Matthew. Matthew 17. All of these are denied by the Quran and Muslims. All of these are. The firmness that's done here with Jesus Christ is denied. Matthew 17, verse 5. "While he yet spoke, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and behold, a voice came out of the cloud which said, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear you him." Let's go to Psalm 2. It's a different line of thinking than we're used to, because we take for granted we know Jesus Christ is the Son of God, but they say, no, he's not. He wasn't crucified. They're telling you, no, you're wrong. The basis of what you believe is wrong. And if we can eliminate Jesus Christ from your thinking, then we can eliminate Christianity as a whole, because the basis is false. See? Psalm 2, verse 7. "And I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, 'You are my Son. This day have I begotten you.'" Forecasted before Jesus Christ, forecasted before Muhammad, forecasted and brought to fruition all the way through the promises, death, resurrection of Jesus Christ, before we ever knew who Muhammad was. You see, they're going to try the best they can, the Muslims, to establish themselves. If they can eliminate Jesus Christ and say it's only Allah, then what they can do is they have more knowledge than you. They're trying to say that there are things with the Bible that are contradictory. There's a lot of things contradictory in here. Okay? But they take them at face value. Okay? What they'll do is they'll say, what's been given later is more important than what was given earlier. So if it's changed later than earlier, then the later takes precedence. So if you say, go 10 paces to the right over here, and it tells you over here, go 10 places to the left, later is what you're supposed to do. That's the way this is interpreted. Not the consistency of the Bible. The Bible says, go 10 this way here, and over here it says, go 10 this way. It's consistent. All right? Whatever it instructs you is consistent. Don't lie, don't cheat, to steal. They're allowed to lie, cheat, and steal, as long as it furthers the coming of Allah. And what actually brings that on the face of the earth is if Sharia law, which is the law of this Bible, is established throughout the continents. If that's established throughout the continents, then Allah will return. And they are allowed to do whatever is necessary to make that Sharia law established itself in any continent. Okay? So, it's difficult, because if someone says, oh, I really wasn't there, when they really were there, because they want you to believe something different than the truth, you can't believe what's coming out of their mouth, because their motive is just to get Sharia law in that area. And today, when you see going on in voting today, that's a lot of what you see going on. A lot of lying happening. Okay, I hope that helps some of what's happening today in the news. Okay, let me see here. I lost track. Okay, let's go to Luke 21. That's why it's important that we have a good grasp of the plan of God, not just through the holy days, but through the covenants as well. That's why it's important. You don't lose track of that. Because Jesus Christ is central to those plans. You know, Jesus Christ is central to those plans. That's what makes those plans what they are. If you take Jesus Christ out of them, you don't have those plans. And they know that. That's why they don't want Jesus Christ in there. Okay, Luke 21. Now remember, it's Satan when I'm talking about that. I'm talking about Satan. They're people like us, find themselves in different positions. And it's hard to love people that have a different perspective. Okay? But we are asked to do that. You know, and that's a critical point not to miss. Luke 21, verse 29. "And he spoke to them a parable. Behold, the fig tree and all the trees, when they shoot forth, you see, you know of your own selves that summer is now near at hand. So likewise you, when you see these things shall come to pass, know you that the kingdom of God is near at hand. Verily I say to you, this generation shall not pass away till all things be fulfilled. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away. So take heed to yourself, brethren, lest at any time your heart be overcharged, be weighted down with surfeiting, with drunkenness, cares of this life, so the day come upon you unawares or suddenly. For as a snare shall it come on all them that dwell on the face of the whole earth. So watch. Watch and pray always that you may be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. Watch. Brethren, we need to watch. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 1. 1 Corinthians 1. And verses 23 and 24. Very clear, Paul says here. But we preach Christ crucified. To the Jews it's a stumbling block, and to the Greeks it's foolishness. And to the Muslims it doesn't exist. If I had to add it in there, that's what Paul would have added. And to the Muslims, it didn't happen. The communities that are of the Jewish nature, of the Christian nature, they can discuss a lot about who Christ was. One would say he never came because they put him to death. The others will say, yes, he did come. But you're still acknowledging God the Father in a discussion of Jesus Christ. There's no discussion of Jesus Christ here. It's removed. Period. So all of you in here are wrong. Do you understand that? That's what they're saying. You Western civilized people that have this Bible that you live by, what you do, how you breathe, eat, and sleep, you decadent infidels, that's how you're looked at. And every rule along the way is to stop that. It's a very serious time on the face of the earth. This whole thing going on with the Libyan ambassador and why they're denying it, okay, has a lot to do with religion. Has a lot to do with religion. And you're not going to see them bring that point up very much. You'll see very little of it. Almost none. Meanwhile, it is prophesied, and hopefully we'll hit that a little bit harder here in a minute. It's prophesied that the Ishmaelites, which is now Islam, will go from India all the way across to the Atlantic Ocean. If you look now, that is all Muslim, complete, all the way across. It's developed over the time period from when this promise was given. Are they princes? Yeah, they are. Are they kings, 12 kings, like Ishmael was told, like Hagar was told? Yeah, they are. Do they control riches? Yes, they do. The prophecies that were given back there are still coming, just like they said. Are they wild men? Yes, they are. On the other hand, the covenanted people are carrying on as well. God's weaving this together in a way where I don't think we even saw this a few years ago. Some people might have. But if you really stretch it out a little more, I don't remember hearing a lot about it or even paying attention to it. You know, maybe some of you have, but I haven't personally. So I find interest that so much has happened like underneath my nose and I didn't even smell it. Here's some statistics you might find interesting. In 1996, there were 80 mosques in the United States. Today, there are 2,100. Okay? I was figuring out what that means. That means they're building 2 mosques a week. 2 mosques a week. And they've been doing that for 16, 17 years. That's a lot. That's a lot of infiltration. People say, oh, well, they're only 2% of the population. Well, the minute they go more into politics, the minute they get more into government, the minute they start to establish Amendment 8, Amendment 8 on your constitutional voting that's coming up this week. It's to allow for the government to give money to religious organizations without auditing the gift. It was stated it was there specifically to start soup kitchens. Do you need an amendment to the Constitution to start a soup kitchen? What you need an amendment to the Constitution to is to give free money away to a group that wants to establish itself in your country. You don't need that. You don't need that. Churches have been having soup kitchens since the Depression. Nobody had to pass a constitutional amendment for you to start it. You can start a soup kitchen tomorrow. But what you can't do is take the money from the government. That's what you can't do. See? So this is very deep in the fabric of what's going on here. A lot of these mosques, more than 80% of them, are operated by what they call Wahhabis. Okay, Wahhabi clerics. Wahhabism is an extreme sect of Islam. They are the legalists that make what's in here actually happen. They're subtle. They're very managerial. They are very intelligent, very articulate, usually well-funded, and very quiet in your society. If you ever notice a mosque comes up, there's always a little modular building in front. And then it seems like overnight there's this gold dome behind it. It's not on the front of the road. If you look around, they're not on the front of the road. The one that's on Morris Bridge Road in Tampa, the one that's on Harney, and they have a way of developing themselves in the fabric of society, and you don't even know it's there. There are some good people who have this belief system, because some of their verses in here tell you how important it is to serve the infidel, to serve those that are poor, to serve those that are needing help, or suffer the wrath of Allah. There are people like that within the Islam religion that do that. One of my business partners lives in Switzerland, and he goes to Istanbul about once a quarter. One of the most developed cities in the world. He left his wallet in a taxi. Not intentionally. Wasn't testing him. They tracked him down and gave it to him. How did they find out where he was? He still marvels that they were able to track him down and give it to him. It's because in that city, lights are on at nighttime, you can walk with your purse open, money in your hand, anywhere, anytime in that city. Because in that city, if you steal something, you're going to lose your hands. And they know it. Now, the principle of direct correction when something is wrong is in the Bible. But you can misapply it as well. But in the city of Istanbul, extremely well developed. Extremely courteous and respectful. Okay? But you don't take an English version of this there. And you don't take one of these there. You play by their rules. So when you mix the good with the bad, it's interesting how people can start to take note of the good in those circumstances and support it. Blindly support it. This week I went to a nonprofit group that's over here in Pinellas County. I spent a morning there because I was talking about how I helped them do some funding. And this group used to be called the Judeo-Christian Community of Tampa Bay, JCC. They dropped the Judeo-Christian side of their title to Community Tampa Bay in 2006. And so I had a lot of questions. Well, why did you do that? Because why would you do that? You know. Well, the reason they would do it is because now they've taken on a new way. The new way now has to do with complete religious discrimination or not being discriminating. How to fight it. How to tolerate it. How to allow for gay marriages. How to allow for gay relations in high school. This group takes 60 kids over to Ecker Junior College for a week, 5 days, 4 nights, three or four groups a year, and trains them how to respond to these so-called injustices. So that these young people will not feel bullied when they're going to act like a gay person. They won't feel bullied when somebody says something about them. Now, do we want our kids bullied? No, 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 we don't. But do we want our kids knowing the difference between right and wrong? To accept what is wrong as right? It's strong delusion, brethren. It's strong for an adult. So for these young people to be in the middle of some of that, it's very injurious. You turn the clock up 20 years after these young people have bought into it, and you have a problematic society that we have not seen. We have not seen that. Where your rules and your laws and the things that you believe are firm, everything goes. Just as long as your tolerance, okay, it's all good. Dude, it's all good. No, it's not all good. It's not all good. What's good is what Jesus Christ and God the Father say is good. That's what's good. And anything else outside of that is not good, because it comes from the other ruler of this earth. We find Ishmael and the followers of Ishmael struggling for the blessing of God. And that's what it is. You see it in families. Some say, oh, well, you're the favorite. Dad likes you better than he likes me. Am I right? And the other one, the one that's not loved as much, is just, I just want him to love me. I want him to do homework with me. I want him to play ball with me. I want him to go out with me. I want him to like what I wear, what I pick out, what I do. That's what this is in grown-up terms. And until God's blessing is actually brings this all together, which happens when? When Jesus Christ returns. Until that happens, this will continue. And it will be more predominant as you watch it. I wish Jesus Christ would come today. I don't want to be any older than I am. I don't want to be more achy. And I don't want to see my kids suffer. And I don't want to see the kids in here suffer. Or the people in here suffer as they get older. That's not, I didn't sign up for that. But when you read these scriptures, it's very clear that God knew that all of this would happen and it would shape inside these chemical bodies something worth value that wouldn't look like this. It would have value. And that value would be eternal value. And that's what God was after with this plan. So as you start to see this thing develop, don't lose track of the Holy Days of Covenants, and the central part of that is Jesus Christ. That's the central part of the discussion. And when people tried to remove it, I don't know how brave I would be, but I think I would stand my ground on this, even up to my last breath. I think I would. Would I? I don't know. Okay? And you have to examine your own heart and your own conviction on that. But that's what this is about. Now, when you start talking about the Antichrist, I can sure see it here a lot more than I can see it in the Catholic Church. Honestly, I could. Although I will say, the Crusades were nasty. Okay? And when you look at what the Muslims were doing, that was nasty. When you start telling people, I'm going to kill you if you don't believe what I believe, that's nasty. No matter who you are, that's nasty. You know? Okay, that was known as a sidetrack. I'm going to read you some quotes from some of the books. I've bought about a dozen books on this subject, and I tried to buy them where it's not beating a drum from one group or another. I try to use prayerful discernment and being close to God to say, I know the difference between what's good and bad here, what's right and what's wrong. Because I think that's what we're supposed to do, is have discernment. You know, not milk, but meat. Okay, here's one here, written a book called Muhammad by K. Armstrong, a biography of the prophet. Not related, as I know, to Mr. Herbert Armstrong at all. It's called Muhammad, a biography of the prophet. The historicists among the Protestants continue to affirm that the image of Daniel has its two legs, and that their separation of the East and West is constituted by the evolution of the Antichrist system. Interesting comment. Because we know this, the dream in Daniel. The first president of Princeton University, Jonathan Edwards, wrote in his History of the Work of Redemption, can you imagine the president of Princeton University writing a work today about the work of redemption of God? It's just not going to happen. They don't even acknowledge God in prayer anymore. where all the Ivy League schools were steeped in that. They were founded on the Constitution of the Bible. Anyway, he wrote in this book the following condemnatory lines against the papacy, Pope, and Islam. The two great works of the devil which he wrought against the kingdom of Christ are his anti-Christian, Romish, or papal, and Mohammedan, Muslim, or Islamic kingdoms. He's claiming those are your two legs of your statue. It's an interesting thought. It's a very interesting thought. Which have been, and still are, two kingdoms of great extent and strength. Both together swallow up the ancient Roman Empire, the papal kingdom of Antichrist swallowing up the Western Empire, and the Satan's Mohammedan kingdom of the Eastern Empire. It is the destruction of these two that the glorious victory of Christ is at the introduction of our times. Just making sure he's okay. I have never heard that before, that the two legs could be Islam and the papacy that go into Rome. Never heard that before. And I open it up for you to consider. I'm not saying it is that, because I don't know. But I do know the dream's there. And I do know God says that that dream represents something going to happen before the rock comes out of someplace not made by hands, meaning Jesus Christ, and strikes the feet of that statue. I do know that, because it tells you what that is. Here's another quote. It's written from John Calvin. In a sermon on 2 Timothy 1:3, Calvin explained, "The Turks at this day can allege and say for themselves, 'We serve God from our ancestors.' It is a good while ago since Muhammad gave them a cup of his devilish dreams to drink, and they got drunk with them. It's about 1,000 years since those cursed hellhounds were made drunk with their follies. But let us be wise and discreet. Otherwise, we shall be like the Turks and the heathen ourselves." He pointed out that the reign of Antichrist will be destroyed by the word of God. He was right. There's other things he might not be right about, but he was right about that. From a book called, and Mr. Zimmerman gave me this one, The Sword of Islam, by a fellow by the name of John Murphy, I found this. "To this day, the association of Islam with the events of the apocalypse in the minds of ardent Protestants align the events of Revelation 6:3 and of the second horseman and the second seal with Islam's wrath and sword upon the earth." And this is the quote. "For a while, it must have seemed that the Muslims would overwhelm all of Christian Europe. However, in 732 at the Battle of Tours, a Muslim army which had advanced into the center of France was at last defeated by the Franks. Nevertheless, in a scant century of fighting, these Bedouin tribesmen, inspired by the word of Muhammad, had carved out," interesting choice of words because it's used in the seal 2 in Revelation, "an empire stretching from the borders of India to the Atlantic Ocean, the largest empire that the world had yet seen." This is now 15 years old, this book, and it has increased 30% since this was said. 30% more territory is under the control of this. "From the above, it can be seen that Muhammad was indeed given a great sword, one with which he took peace from the earth. He also, like Constantine, achieved success in two different ways, as a military conqueror and as a religious leader." It's quite interesting. "Who is a liar but he who denies that Jesus is the Christ? He is the Antichrist who denies that the Father and the Son. Whoever denies the Son, as did Muhammad, does not have the Father either. He who acknowledges the Son also has the Father." So how could you have Allah without the Son? "These scriptures plainly show that it is impossible to know God unless manifested through the Lord Jesus Christ. Thus his denial that Jesus was the Christ unquestionably proves Muhammad could not have been a true prophet from God." another book. This one's only a couple years old, called The Apocalypse of Muhammad. If you're not a reader, there's a lot of stuff to read on this out there. And it's interesting to read it. Today there exists only one religion that is intent on the total obliteration of Jews first and other religions afterward, and that is Islam. No other religion has hated more or done more so blatantly to rid the world of Jews than any other religion that refuses to adopt Muhammad's twisted version of both Judaism and Christianity as taught in the Quran. They have shown time and time again to be brutal, dominating, and commanding itself by the Quran. They can lie to achieve the furtherance of Islam. In this day and age, as clerics are yelling from mosques about the ushering in of the last imam, that's the leader, we have seen Islam display the characteristics of the Antichrist as described in the Bible. Now remember that when he had these dreams, the Bible was already written. So when you see these issuances or degrees from him about treating the infidel properly, about loving your neighbor and all that, that's hijacked from Christianity. That's where he got that from, and from Jewish literature. Okay? In his dreams, he melted together Christian writings, Jewish teachings and writings, and Arabic tradition. He put those three together, mixed them up in a pot, and poof! He got the Quran. That's what happened. Let's see, I think I have one more, maybe a couple more. Yeah, two more articles I want to read for you. This one's from a book called Islam by Jim Searcy. Muhammad is the most successful of all false prophets. He is the greatest of Satan's prophets. He taught hatred as a substitute for love of God revealed in Yahshua Messiah. He taught the self-righteousness and hypocrisy of man as the substitute for the faith righteousness given to man by God through the shed blood of Jesus Christ. In the last days, Satan, the deceiving God of Muhammad, will greatly use Islam to assist the Antichrist in his war on the saints. For the next imam, leader of Persia, or Iran, will be a major false prophet of Antichrist. Imam is used in the Quran to mean leader, guide, model, or sign. The Sunnites use imam as a title for the caliphs, the successors of the Muhammad as leaders in the Muslim community. Muslims are wide open for demonic possession. Muhammad received the gospel of Satan from an angel of light. Muslims do not have Bibles. Bibles are not allowed in Muslim countries. And when the war in heaven is concluded, as Satan's demonic hosts are cast down to the earth, they will have many human bodies prepared for their possession through the religion of Islam. And the next imam of all Islam will be a major false prophet. He will display spectacular demonic power and encourage all Muslims to follow the leadership of the Antichrist to destroy Bible-believing Christians and Jews. These are just a few of them. These are just a few of them. So if you've just been kind of, you know, lackadaisically not paying attention to this, you probably should. You probably should pay attention to the develop here. For the first time in the last couple years, not even a couple years, last year, I have seen people now walking up and down the streets of Hillsborough in Tampa now that are fully dressed as Muslims. I don't have any problem with them. They come into my apartments, they come into one of my units, they come near me. I treat them as well as I can. But it is clear in my mind what I believe. It is clear in my mind that they are not offering my tenants in some of my buildings to disabled people. They will take them to their soup kitchen on a Friday. The bus comes, picks them up, says, "Are you hungry?" Okay? Take them to the soup kitchen, feed them. When they bring them home, they install a flat screen TV in their house. And then they're connected to their services from there on. It's a true story. They tell the black folks, we have a few that are brethren, I wish we had more that were brethren in this congregation. I don't see skin color. Okay, they tell the black folks that they are from the sons of Kedar, and that the black line comes from the sons of Kedar. That comes from that line, and their heritage is from that line. That's what they tell them. Why would you be with the Israelites when your heritage is over here? They don't offer the grafting in, the sacrifice of Christ for all men in the way it was taught and the way it was intended. They don't do that. And by doing that message, they have great success in the black neighborhoods, in Africa and all those places that are black across there. That's why. That's the reasoning. Because they accept that as their heritage, which is incorrect. Before we went to the feast, this happened. Read the article for you. Last week in Egypt, when Muslim Brotherhood supporters terrorized the secular media. Do you remember that in Egypt, the president is part of the Muslim Brotherhood, right? Several Arabic websites, including the Arab News, Al-Khabar News, Doster, Watney, and Egypt Now, reported that people were literally being crucified. This is right before the feast. This is just a few weeks ago. The relevant excerpt follows in this translation. A Sky News Arabic correspondent in Cairo confirmed that protesters belonging to the Muslim Brotherhood crucified those opposing Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi naked on trees in front of the presidential palaces while abusing others. Likewise, the Muslim Brotherhood supporters locked the doors of the media and production facilities of October 6th major media outlet in Cairo when they proceeded to attack several popular journalists. The attacks and violence, both in front of Egypt's presidential palace and at major media facilities, are well documented. In other words, they weren't going to do anything. It was in front of the presidential palace. Go ahead, do it to him, because he was a Muslim, thinking like a Muslim, and was treating these people like this book tells him to. Al-Balad adds, Al-Balad is the Egyptian website that is very popular there, like a Google kind of site where you go there for information. It's only about news, though. A vocal critic in there was a supporter of a guy by the name of Okasha, is his last name, and he's very vocal about this president and his stifling ways when it comes to his Muslim tradition. So when this guy was on this website, critically and openly and widely disseminating these different kinds of discussions on the internet about the president, they surrounded the place where he was with Brotherhood supporters, attacked them with sticks, knives, Molotov cocktails, crucifying some of them on trees, leading to the death of two and wounding a dozen. Now remember, this is before the Libyan thing that they're still trying to figure out. There's really not a lot of figuring it out. See? They're viewed, like I told you, were viewed by them. These threats are not new. Back in April, an organization called the Jihad Group to Cleanse the Country threatened these media with painful and severe punishments. You wonder why the media is not reporting against it? Are you picking these things up? Apparently, now that Morsi has become master of Egypt, these threats are becoming reality, just as promises are being broken left and right. In reality, there is little reason. This is before the Libyan embassy. In reality, there is little reason to doubt this crucifixion story. For militant Muslims, crucifying their opponents is a regular featured article of the Islamic World. Recent cases coming from the Ivory Coast, where two Christian brothers were crucified. Ivory Coast is where all that piracy takes place. Similarly, by supporters of a Muslim president who ousted a Christian Indonesian, where Islamic separatists crucified a fellow Muslim for being a military informant. Do you think Satan has anything to do with the fact that they use crucifixion as their way of punishment? There's a lot to learn here, you know, and we are told in the Quran, chapter 5, verse 33, don't turn there. Those that make war against God and his apostle and spread disorder, the apostle being Muhammad, and spread disorder in the land shall be slain or crucified or have their hands and feet cut off on alternate sides or be banished from the land. That's where they get it from. We are told to watch and pray always. And my hope today is to alert you of some of those changes. My hope is to tell you how important it is that we're close to God. How important it is that we pay attention to what's going on in the world. When he said to watch and pray always, you're going to pray a lot harder when you start to believe what's going on before your face. You pray a lot harder when you've been told you have cancer. You pray a lot harder when somebody's been hurt bad in an accident. Well, I hope you'll pray a lot harder when you see what's going on in the world today. Because this is not child stuff anymore. It's become more serious, and it can become personal real quickly. Luke 21. Verse 36. Watch you therefore, brethren, and pray always that you may be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass, and, most importantly, to stand before the Son of Man. Cannot make apologies for God. He doesn't make mistakes. He's always able to adjust the situation to his time and purposes. We have story after story throughout history where God has made adjustments for us. In Genesis 17, let's go back there real quick. It's our last scripture. Genesis 17. We read this earlier. And Abraham fell upon his face and laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born to him that is 100 years old? Yep, you bet it would be. Because God said so. That's why that happened, because God said so. In verse 19, and God said, Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son indeed, and you shall call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant and with his seed after him. God's promise to us. And as for Ishmael, I have heard you, and behold, I have blessed him and will make him fruitful and will multiply him exceedingly. 12 princes shall he father, and I will make him a great nation. But, my covenant, God says, will I establish with Isaac, which Sarah shall bear to you at this set time in the next year. It isn't until Jesus Christ returns till we find that these two will come together. No matter how hard we try to fight through these different terms, tolerance, etc., etc. In the beginning, we referenced a story about two brothers who wished to bless each other and, you know, with their grain, their status of life, taking into consideration where the other one was. And so it is that I hope that the day will come when all families will see how blessed it can be when people get along, when God's Spirit rules, when God's blessing is on everyone, and that all of us would be converted and would lay under the protective arm of Jesus Christ.